Good morning. If you noticed something different when you walked in, the windows are all blacked out. We're going to be doing something a little different today for chapel, so I hope you'll bear with me. I think in the end it'll all make sense and provide a challenge to you. We're going to watch a documentary today. But before we get to the documentary, I do want to say this, and I really mean this. When Asbury students and Asbury professors do things together, amazing things can happen. In all sorts of ways. The documentary that you're going to see today was produced and directed by Professor Greg Bandy from MediaCom. And if you recognize a voice as the narrator, it's his, if it seems somewhat familiar. I wrote most of it. Asbury students shot the entire documentary you're going to see, and Asbury alum edited it. So before I get to the main program, I do want to say when Asbury students and professors work together, amazing things can happen. 50 years ago, this fall, 1963, the man that many people recognize as the most influential Christian writer of the last 100 years passed away in his home just outside of Oxford, England. To mark that 50th anniversary, today's chapel, the showing this documentary will be one part. We're also going to have a very special guest here that I want to mention briefly. One week from today, Douglas Gresham will be speaking in chapel. He's the stepson of C.S. Lewis. If you saw Shadowlands, he's the little boy that was portrayed there. He's been the producer of the 3 Narnia films. He'll be speaking in chapel at 10. He'll be speaking at the MediaCom building at 4 o'clock. And then at 7 o'clock, one week from today on Monday night, we're going to have a special multimedia and evening with Douglas Gresham, conversation with him about life with his stepfather, C.S. Lewis, the making of the Narnia films, and his own amazing journey. So be sure not to miss any of those events. Some famous people are going to be speaking to you in a moment or two, really famous. Eric Metaxas, Tim Keller, best-selling New York Times selling authors, Christian writers. Michael Flaherty, the president of Walden Media, is here to speak to you today. And Douglas Gresham is going to make a special guest appearance in the documentary you're going to see. All a testament to the influence that C.S. Lewis, his writing and thinking, has had on them. By the way, it's okay if C.S. Lewis isn't your favorite author. It's okay if you don't even like his writing. But I guess what I want to say is we're here to honor someone who dedicated his life to serving the Lord and to look at his life as a challenge to our own. There's an old saying. It's actually a very old saying. When the pupil is ready, the master will appear. God has a special way of sending just the right person at just the right time to teach each of us the exact lesson we are supposed to learn. And for countless Christians all over the world, young and old, C.S. Lewis has been a teacher and a mentor whose books and writings appeared at just the right time in their lives, just when they were needed most. The documentary you're about to see seeks to answer the question, why C.S. Lewis, an Oxford scholar who specialized in Renaissance literature, still matters today, 50 years after his death back in 1963. Clive Staples Lewis was born in Belfast, Northern Ireland, in 1898. He died 65 years later in the sleepy English village of Headington Quarry, leaving behind for us 40 books of Christian apologetics, poetry, literary criticism, science fiction, and the most amazing set of fairy tales ever written. Though it's hard to imagine a world without the Screwtape Letters, hard to imagine a world without Mere Christianity, and very hard to imagine a world without the Chronicles of Narnia, C.S. Lewis very nearly took a different path in life. In part one here, we learn that Professor Lewis was not always a famous Christian writer. In fact, he was not always even a Christian. Part one, prologue.
As the Industrial Revolution rolled to the end of the 19th century, a new revolution began that would transform much of Western civilization. The dawn of the 20th century revealed the beginning of a radical shift in the way many thinkers and leaders viewed the world and our place in it. Ancient documents, previously held to be divine biblical truth for centuries, were now seen as only primitive superstitions, comforting illusions that had nothing to do with reality. Hard sciences took the place formerly held by philosophy and their realms of study. That which can be seen, touched, and measured became the only area of study with any claim on truth. Men and women were no longer seen as being created in the image of God, or even created at all. Humans were like all life on Earth, merely advanced animals, evolved through meaningless, purposeless chance. And God became merely a figment of childish wishes, something intelligent adults outgrew, like an infant's nursery. It was into this world that Clive Staples Lewis was born in 1898, and it was here that he was raised and educated. He quickly became one of its more vocal adherents. As a young man, he wrote to a friend, "I believe in no religion. There is absolutely no proof for any of them. And from a philosophical standpoint, Christianity is not even the best. All religions, that is, all mythologies, to give them a proper name, are merely man's inventions." In 1925, after graduating with highest honors from Oxford with degrees in philosophy and literature, Lewis was invited to join the faculty. Before long, he became close friends with the company of believers, chief among them, J.R.R. Tolkien. Much to Lewis's surprise, it was they who began to influence him rather than the reverse. Through these friends, Lewis came to see Christianity as intellectually credible, and despite his great desire to simply be left alone by God, his great change gradually began to take place. About his conversion, Lewis wrote, "In the Trinity term of 1929, I gave in and admitted that God was God and knelt and prayed. Perhaps that night, the most dejected and reluctant convert in all of England."
After Lewis's conversion, he went on not just to become a Christian and a strong Christian, but the most influential Christian writer of the 20th century.
He has an ability to speak about God in a way that doesn't just talk about the imagination, but that actually uses imagination and that pulls our imagination in, which I would make the argument that without that, you can't really know God. And so there's something about Lewis's role in the canon of Western literature that is genuinely unique.
He not only provided this clear articulation of what it means to be a Christian in his own life, he demonstrated what it means to be a Christian in today's modern world.
Christianity for Lewis was something that captured the mind, fired the imagination, and filled the heart. Becoming a Christian was something that changed the very way he viewed the world and the people who lived in it.
In the next part of exploring why C.S. Lewis matters today, we will learn of his great efforts to reclaim Christian reason and to restore it to its proper place. In his writings and his own life as well, Professor Lewis showed us how to love God not just with all your heart, but also with all your mind. He encouraged Christians everywhere to ask questions about their faith, serious questions, and to search for serious answers. Part two, reclaiming Christian reason.
By presenting a defense of the Christian faith that appealed to reason, Lewis removed obstacles to belief that many people faced.
Lewis saw reason as being the anchor of faith. He knew that a faith that was based only on emotions would be the kind of faith that would change from one moment to the next.
Faith in the sense in which I am here using the word, he wrote, is the art of holding on to things your reason has once accepted in spite of your changing moods. Lewis pointed out, our hearts must be on fire for the things of God, and so must our reason. While God wants us to be as loving and teachable as children, Lewis underlined that God also wants every bit of intelligence we have.
He's the best that God has given us so far as at reaching his world, at fencing with stupidity, and of ever so gently, but knife with a little twist in it, puncturing the pomposity and the pretensions of so-called thinkers.
For example, in Miracles, when he actually goes after the idea that you can't trust your reason, you can't trust your thinking if we simply are the product of random chance evolution. That's a kind of presuppositional argument. He's basically saying, if there is no God, you can't actually even trust your reason. And of course, Alvin Plantinga later on has took that idea and has developed it much more completely. So he uses all kinds of arguments. They've been extremely helpful to me.
When the imagination is divorced from reason, when faith is divorced from reason, we go in all sorts of strange directions. Lewis is an absolute consummate genius in bringing together and keeping together, tied in a good strong knot, faith and reason. And so by following Lewis, we are following the path of orthodoxy. In other words, the path of Christianity, which is rational and faithful.
Lewis showed us through his own example as a world-class literature scholar at one of the world's premier institutions of learning what it means to have a mind of Christ and to love God with all your heart and all your mind.
For example, he talks about naturalism, the idea that there is not a creator, that we are simply a material product. We are the result of some natural processes of evolution. And he says people who believe that have a deep problem because they have to rely upon a brain that was formed by a natural process to make an informed judgment. So how can they know that their brain is reliable? He said naturalism is like someone trying to lift himself up by his collar. He won't be able to get off the ground, but he may strangle himself.
He started out totally an agnostic, searching every option, other religions, science, atheism. He looked at everything. And the fact is, he gave it a long-term, concentrated, serious study. And at the end of the path, he found Christianity.
I think his most important contributions in general to the world have been, well, obviously his books of Christian apologetics, A Grief Observed being one of them, Mere Christianity, The Great Divorce. His science fiction trilogy are hugely advantageous for people to read because not only are they great literature and great science fiction, but they're also hugely instructive about the nature of man. At the time Jack wrote those, the tradition in science fiction was that man went out into the stars and met the alien monsters who tried to kill everybody and so forth. Jack turned that on his head, and man goes out into the stars and is the alien monster that tries to kill everybody.
For Lewis, loving God with all your mind was not really just reading a book or two, but a call to be a whole different kind of person. For Lewis, this call to use your reason and your faith together was not just an intellectual pursuit, but a way of being very present in today's modern world.
By restoring reason to its rightful place, Lewis showed how Christianity could appeal to those who were earnestly seeking for answers to the great questions of life.
Some Christians today view the imagination with distrust, but Lewis felt that the purpose of the Christian imagination is not merely to make wonders into fact, but to take the facts of our everyday world and reveal the wonder that is in them. As we will see for Professor Lewis, the primary value of a Christian imagination was not to make things up, but to allow us to see things as they really are. His imaginative fairy tales were intended to stir and to trouble us with a glimpse of something just beyond our grasp. Part 3, Rediscovering Christian Imagination.
As a boarding school student, Lewis labeled the mandatory chapel just an opportunity to daydream. Looking back on a childhood of tedious church lessons filled with cliches and formulaic answers, the adult Lewis turned to the imagination to recapture the true power of the gospel.
And he said that his faith became paralyzed because of what he called its stained glass associations. By recasting these elements, these spiritual truths from the gospel story, into an imaginary world, he hoped that he could, for the first time, at least for him, convey them in their true potency, their real power.
But Lewis understood that learning is not just by the mind alone. The mind, he said, is the organ of reason, but the imagination is the organ of understanding. So you need both reason, both cognitive understanding, and the imagination, and that nothing penetrates the imagination better than Lewis's writing, and particularly his fantasies, which are so popular with children.
He said why he thought Narnia was so effective is that the passion of Aslan took people by surprise. They were very familiar with the whole Jesus story, but that Aslan's death and resurrection, they didn't see it coming, and therefore it was much more moving to them. And I think that's the hallmark of all good myth, is that it flies under the radar of your defenses. You have your defenses up against Christian truth. Nah, don't believe that, don't want to go there, don't tell me about it, don't want to hear it. But you get dragged into Tolkien, or you get dragged into Lewis. We have testimonies in our worship services quite frequently, and just recently we've had both a Tolkien and a Lewis conversion testimony.
Lewis's own particular brand of evangelism, I think he would say, didn't take a direct form. It wasn't come down the altar and be baptized. He might even call it pre-evangelism. He saw that his gift, his own particular gift, was to break down the kind of obstacles to belief that people had then and still have today.
So we take reason seriously, as we should, but then we take it too seriously, and we forget that there are some things, notably the gospel and the truth of the gospel, that cannot only be communicated via reason. It has to be communicated via story.
You're able to access the meaning through your imagination, and it awakens in you a hunger for something that you really didn't know that you were hungry for.
The idea of story, it's a fundamentally, intrinsically human concept, the notion of story and narrative, which is genuinely essential for communicating the kind of truth that we find in the gospel. If we're talking about just rational truth, we're talking about facts, then you don't need it. But when you're talking about the gospel of Jesus Christ, you're talking about something that necessarily needs, at least in part, to be communicated via story, period.
And Lewis and Tolkien realized that the imagination is the means by which we arrive at the truth. And the imagination is not in conflict with reason. In fact, if the imagination leads us in an irrational direction to an irrational area, it's a failure of the imagination as well as a failure of the reason.
I think Lewis, as a medieval scholar, as someone who had studied the mythology of Norsemen, of Greeks, was well steeped in the power of imagination, the power of story, and the power of creativity. He combined that with his faith in a way that just opened people's eyes to imagining a world where the story of Christ wasn't a myth, but was a lived reality.
If somebody had tried to hit me with Jesus, I had all kinds of cultural misconceptions, preconceptions, that would have just made me uninterested. But because Aslan is in a myth, mythological mode, you're able to access truth with your imagination that your mind would have defenses against.
You think I'm trying to weave a spell, Lewis writes. Perhaps I am. But remember your fairy tales. Spells are used for breaking enchantments, as well as for inducing them. And you and I have need of the strongest spell that can be found to wake us from the evil enchantment of the worldliness which has been laid upon us for nearly a century. Almost our whole education has been directed to silencing this shy, persistent inner voice.
I read a quote the other day that truth will always be more important than the facts. And I think to really understand what real truth is, the imagination has to be a part of that. And I think C.S. Lewis understood it very well.
C.S. Lewis believed that Christian imagination could expand our sense of what's possible. He believed the Christian imagination could re-enchant a world that has been disenchanted by the limited possibilities of modern science.
Lewis was well aware of the power that stories created by a Christian imagination have to present understandable concepts which could be approached in no other fashion, a kind of writing that could express the inexpressible.
In part 4, we look at Professor Lewis's goal of restoring a Christian vision of humanity. We live in a world where people are often viewed like replaceable parts of a machine, merely objects to be used, manipulated, and then tossed aside. In this world, C.S. Lewis pointed out the glorious potential of each individual and emphasized each person's eternal destiny. Part 4, restoring a Christian view of humanity.
As a young atheist, C.S. Lewis agreed with many other thinkers of his day that the universe was all there is, that life was just an accident, and that human beings were nothing more than a result of random evolution. But after his conversion, all this changed. The order, complexity, and vastness of the universe became a reflection of a creator, of someone beyond the universe. After coming to a belief in God, Lewis also came to see all life as having a divine origin and saw in human beings the image of that divinity.
What was it that caused C.S. Lewis to risk his academic reputation and to spend just so much time every day, whether in writing letters, speaking on the BBC, publishing essays, writing books? I believe it's this radical vision that Lewis had for the eternal destiny of every human being.
I think that humanity is what enabled him to speak so profoundly into our lives. He's a person who had experienced grief, who'd experienced doubt, who understood that we are all less than perfect and also, you know, right beside the angels.
He speaks to us where we are in a way that almost no one does. There's something about his ability to talk about God in non-religious terms, which is not only important, but at this point, vital.
In today's culture, that emphasis of Lewis, that humanity is of supreme value, very precious as bearing the image of God, is important because of the dehumanizing aspects of culture, whether it's through media or through scientific advance. People misconstrue those to devalue and dehumanize. And Lewis was always a sworn opponent of that kind of trend.
Today we live in a media-driven culture where people are bombarded with media messages every day. Some researchers indicate 5,000 a day messages we're getting bombarded with. In that world, we are beat down, we are lectured to, we are hammered on, and I think we grow smaller and smaller and smaller in our own eyes. I think Lewis understood the radical view of humanity that we are free, we are liberated, we have, you know, because of what Christ has done on the cross, it's changed everything.
You can't say that every human being has a little God in them the way sort of, you know, some people like to say in our culture today, that we're all children of God in a general way and you know, there's a little bit of God in all of us. There's something to what they're saying, but that's actually more misleading than it is true. I think what they're sensing is that the Bible says God made every human being in the image, in his own image. And that seems to mean there's something about human beings that reflects the glory of God. So there's a dignity about every human being. There's a greatness about human beings, even when they're ruined by sin. And you can sense it. In fact, somebody once said, if you even see a ruined castle, it's still magnificent, even though you can't even live in it. But you can see what it was, and you can see how great it was designed to be. And there's something magnificent even about the ruin. And I think that even ruined by sin, human beings, being in the image of God, have this greatness about them. And therefore, there is a sacredness about them.
Lewis, by using imagination, shows what we really are. It's this biblical idea that we are created in the image of God. And just to think about that doesn't mean that we're cookie cutters, that we're made in the image of God in a simplistic way, but that we are something ineffable, we're something at least in part ethereal, we're something eternal. To be able to communicate that, as Lewis does, is, again, infinitely important. There's almost no one I can think of who's done it the way he's done it.
Well, I mean, that notion that Lewis would often say, that there is no ordinary person, you are talking to an immortal being, and those are the kinds of ideas that you just wouldn't hear at a revival tent meeting. Nothing against revival tent meetings, but it kind of blew a lot of our minds, those kinds of very simple ideas, yet they're rooted in the Christian tradition, but so fresh and so novel. And, you know, you just wonder where those kinds of thoughts came from.
And I think in the Chronicles of Narnia and in the Space Trilogy and in The Great Divorce, he shows how ordinary people are extraordinary. That's the paradox. And, of course, ordinary people are extraordinary because they're made in the image of God, all of us. And we're both unique and yet united in our humanity. And that makes all of us capable of going to heaven and capable of going to hell. So everything we do has eternal significance for ourselves and for others.
C.S. Lewis had a radical view of humanity. Here's what he wrote. There are no ordinary people. You have never talked to a mere mortal. Nations, cultures, arts, civilizations, these are mortal. And their life to ours is as the life of a gnat.
You haven't met a mere mortal because there are no such creatures. We aren't mortal. We are given a choice of which direction to go for our immortality in eternity. But eternity, get used to the eye, you're standing in it.
Born in the final decade of the 1800s, Lewis's life, work, and legacy now spans three centuries. Although he was buried in the churchyard of his local parish 50 years ago, the story of C.S. Lewis leaves us, each of us, today, right here, right now, with a challenge. Today, this morning, this very moment, the same God who called C.S. Lewis first to himself and secondly to his vocation is calling you as well. God is calling you to know him in a deeper way today than you did yesterday, calling you to draw closer to him now than you were before, and challenging you to find your calling in him. What will your vocation be? What will your contribution be? How will you go out into the world and make a difference? We close with the epilogue, a final look at why C.S. Lewis matters today.
The first demand of any great work of art is surrender. Look, listen, receive. Get yourself out of the way. For until you have gotten yourself out of the way, you have no idea whether you should have surrendered or not. An experiment in criticism, C.S. Lewis.
Lewis wrote about this. It is critical that as we call ourselves Christians, that we see some differences being made in the lives of people around us, and in the kinds of things we are doing to demonstrate the gospel, the things that God is calling us to do out of gratitude to him for his son's death on the cross in our place.
And I think a lot of times, as believers, we're always looking for those things that separate us. And we're always looking for those things that we want to criticize in the culture. And we want to cast as much light on things that we think that are wrong. I like the emphasis on finding the things that unite us. And I love the idea of lighting a candle rather than cursing the darkness.
I would like to think that the movies we make are part of Jack's contribution. Entertainment, I believe, should not only entertain, it should not only make money, it should also educate and assist society in general. And I think the Narnian Chronicles movies are doing that to a great degree at a time when they're desperately needed.
He also models what it is for a faithful Christian person to take his gifts and skills and opportunities and sort of parlay them into a contribution to culture that is a faithful witness to Christian faith.
He was the purveyor to popular culture of these wonderful ideas, and that tradition has continued. His ideas live on through bands that I work with like Sixpence None the Richer. They live on through movies like the Narnia movies and through books. And so he's a chain. In fact, his ideas lived on through politicians. There's a great story about Ronald Reagan in 1978 being asked whether Christ was the only path to God. And he regurgitates C.S. Lewis's line that Christ is either liar, lunatic, or Lord. And Reagan gives it spot on. So you have this man, this British man who's been dead for many years, speaking on in pop culture through presidents, through rock bands, and through movies.
Well, I think that the most important thing about Lewis is that the more that he's read, the healthier the church will be. So we have to hope that Lewis in the 21st century, that this Lewis phenomenon, and it has been a phenomenon since his death, and it's an industry now, C.S. Lewis is an industry because the number of people that are reading his books, we have to hope that will continue into the 21st century and throughout the century, because the more people that read C.S. Lewis, the healthier the church will be.
In the end, there is something about taking measure of Lewis's significance that remains beyond our grasp. In the end, the only way to fully appreciate the legacy he left is to pick up his books and to open the doors to the great adventure he left for us inside of them.
Thank you very much. You're dismissed.